I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay respects to elders past and present. Sovereignty was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. My name's Maeve Marsden. I'm your host for today. I'm a writer and theatre maker, probably best known for curating Queer Stories, which is a national LGBTQI+ storytelling project. With Queer Stories, I've hosted hundreds of people sharing personal stories, so memoir and narrative non-fiction are a particular love of mine. I'm joined today by Kaya Wilson and Sarah Dingle to discuss their wonderful new memoirs. Both books explore the discovery of long-held family secrets and their resounding effects on the family's lives, and specifically these two authors. Though they're very different in style and form, and at the end of the session, when every single one of you buys one of their books, you will discover that. Kaya is a writer and tsunami scientist based in Canberra. His work has been published widely, and in 2019, he was the recipient of the New South Wales, Writing New South Wales Varuna Fellowship, where he completed his first book, As Beautiful As Any Other, A Memoir of My Body. This book is a rich exploration of identity, family, growing up, what makes a place home, and so much more. And it opens with the fact that when Kaya came out to his parents as transgender, a year after a near-death surfing accident and just weeks before his father's death, he found out that his father had lived as a gay man for over a decade. Sarah Dingle is an investigative reporter and presenter whose work has won the Walkley Foundation's Our Watch Award, UN Media Peace Prizes, Amnesty Media Prizes, and the Voiceless Media Prize. Sarah was 27 when she found out that she was conceived via a sperm donor, but when she began digging into this history, she discovered only destroyed records and dead ends. Brave New Humans, The Dirty Reality of Donor Conception is her first book, a rigorous record of her investigations into the IVF industry and her own history. Each of you brings a career history to writing in a discipline where one is expected to be impartial. We've got a scientist and a journalist here with us, and yet you've written these deeply personal memoirs about yourselves. I'm really interested to know where your professional instinct and experience either clashed with or supported the writing of your book. Sarah, I mean, yours is a journalistic investigation, but how did you find that kind of grappling with your work experience and the task?
Look, it was excruciating. Mm. Particularly ABC journalists are not supposed to talk about themselves ever. so that was very strange. But and it also felt like quite an egotistical thing to do. But I kept telling myself that if this happened to someone else, I would be right in there because it is a crazy story. And I'm not just saying that because I want to sell books, but it is crazy. Being donor conceived is absolutely insane. And it sometimes feels like the world, and particularly the entire fertility industry, is gaslighting you. So, yes.
So you managed to push through the awkwardness of the professional clash.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, you know, it bleeds into my book all the time. Mm. But I just sort of took as my guiding light the need to be honest. Because if I wrote a book about everything I knew about donor conception and the baby business without saying that I was donor conceived and the manner in which that happened and what I discovered, that would be dishonest. Mm. So instead it is more honest and in a way better professionally, journalistically, to say where I'm coming from and then within that say this is what I've discovered.
Mm. Kaya, you've got a scientific background, and I hope this doesn't offend any scientists in the room, but I was surprised by how poetic and kind of literary your book is. And it started as a diary, right?
Yeah.
Did you expect for it to be published? How did your sort of scientific and poetic traits align to create this book?
Look, I don't know if any first-time author expects to be published. So when I wrote it, I genuinely wrote it for myself. It wasn't something that I set out to do. I really started the day I came back from the doctor and I disclosed that I was questioning my gender. And it was such an othering experience. I just came home and I felt wrong in my body and my clothes. I was like, why did I wear the hoodie? You know, they judged me for my hoodie. And I was like, but it was all like a bit of a misnomer, you know. But then I just started writing and it burnt out of me, you know.
Yeah.
And I wrote probably 1,000-word essay every week till I had about 80,000 words. And then I wanted, then I started to get interest, you know, from publishers and things, and I wanted to turn it into something else, or something a bit more cohesive as a creative work. In terms of science, though, like, I think it's poetic because of science, right? So scientific writing is so rigid and stringent, and I felt so sort of constricted in trying to express something, and, you know, I'd write just, like, one adjective, and it'd be crossed out in red, you know? So, like, having had that experience and trying to be so precise, I sort of tried to take the precision but balloon the creativity, you know, and really enjoy that side of myself. But on a positive note, also, science, like, it gives you a training in evidence, right? Evidence-based is what you strive for, as well as impartiality. I think the purer, the purer motive is the evidence. In my life, I have my science life, and I do have my trans life, and they are generally quite separate. And on some level, we kind of hate each other, but but I straddle both. Yeah. And I try to tackle that in one chapter, which is Inheritance 1, where I look at the evidence in the scientific literature for the sort of origins of gender. And it was incredibly difficult to write and to read. And the scientific literature is not objective, has not been objective towards trans people. It's been harmful and othering, and I felt it in my body, and I wanted to translate that into something personal, and I wanted to point out to each other both their strengths and their flaws, you know? So I hope that chapter comes across. It was built on tension between the two.
Yeah. You've also got a beautiful chapter that talks to climate change and other things, so the science does weave through it. But it's beautiful. It's quite exposing, publishing memoir, and we've discussed this, and this is one of the first sessions each of them have done about the books as they're both being published this week. I don't want to be too reductive, but especially publishing memoir that's about trauma, has the process been cathartic? Has it been re-traumatising? I mean, Kaya, you write about quite bodily traumas in terms of your accident and breaking your neck. How was that physically and emotionally to write about?
Yeah, so in my experience, and I think in the general experience, trauma lives in the body. And I wanted to listen to my body, I wanted to get to know my body, and in doing so, I had to listen to all of it. You know, you can't just block out bits, and that's kind of how I had been living. I mean, very disconnected from my bodily experience. So in listening to it, I had to take it all on. And that included traumatic experience that was in my sort of bodily memory. And the writing of it was very much part of the process of recovery. It wasn't something that I just set out to do. It's completely entwined into my sort of psychological development. And it's the book for me is also part of survivorship, you know. And so I was slightly self-conscious about that. Actually initially hid the trauma chapters in the middle, sort of buried them. But then my publisher was very clear-sighted and was like, no, this is one of the driving forces of this book. Mm. Put it at the front. And now I own it, you know. That's what I've done.
Yeah.
And that's what you'll read.
Sarah, has writing and especially now publishing your book as well as the other journalism you've done about your experiences, has that offered some resolution or catharsis?
I think I was only able to write this book because I had achieved some sort of neither resolution nor catharsis, but just kind of peace. And that came with finally finding parts of my biological family through perhaps means that were outside the system. I won't say underhanded because they weren't. They were perfectly legitimate, but I was not supposed to find these people, and I did, and it helped me feel good. Without that, I don't think I would have been able to write this book, particularly some of the chapters where, like Kaya, I examine, you know, the peer-reviewed studies around unpleasant aspects of being donor-conceived and what is known, for instance, about the risk of things like accidental incest amongst donor-conceived children who have many dozens, perhaps hundreds of completely unknown half-siblings And when you write stuff like that, I found I had to take lots of very long walks with the dog afterwards, because it is very kind of, it would be horrible even being a disinterested journalist on this, writing that sort of stuff. But when you write it and you know that it pertains to your life and people you know and good friends of yours, it's very, very upsetting.
It's exhausting. Yeah. Right. It's very exhausting. I had that experience.
And you lie in bed at night going blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah. you can't sleep. You can't leave it.
Yeah.
Which is quite hard, I think.
Yeah. Well, writers are already often obsessed with whatever they're working on, and when what you're working on is also yourself, I imagine it would be utterly consuming.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think this was during lockdown, so all the effects were probably worsened, and the people I did speak to probably got very sick of it. So, yeah.
I'm sure they supported you as well.
I'm sort of jumping ahead here, but you also were working on your book during the months of lockdown, and the book involves travel and places, all these different places that you'd lived. Was it strange to kind of be restrained from this massive part of your life, which was travel and being away from your family, whilst working on a book about it?
Yeah, I guess I treated, you know, COVID and lockdown like another country, you know? and you... when you do move around, you learn to live where you are and sort of elevate the things that are pleasurable and that work for you, and just kind of let those parts of you kind of grow a little bit. So I think I treated it like that. I mean, it was really beautiful remembering some of the sort of sensual experiences of my childhood, of my experience in different places, because it was lovely to remember those memories as well, like as myself as I am now, and sort of view them with that detachment, but also that connection to my body and my memory. So they were the difficult, exhausting things, but it was also like a sort of like poetic montage, you know? Like, it was fun.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Each of you is now part of a community as an adult, for want of another term, that you didn't know necessarily existed as a child. Donor-conceived children obviously have networks, and you write about the online networks where you've found other donor-conceived children to connect with, and obviously for you, Kaya, being part of the trans community now. As marginalised people, when we write about these experiences, aware that we're often the first or one of the first writing on it, there can be a sense of responsibility, and I'm curious as to whether or how you considered your community whilst writing, and potentially some of the feedback that you might have received from others like you, or somewhat like you, but not exactly like you. Sarah?
Well, it's true. Nobody talks about us very much or to us. And so one of the first things I would say is that we're not children. We're adults. Yes. And I know you know that, Maeve.
Yep.
In fact, I have interviewed donor-conceived people for this book who are grandparents, dealing with all the questions and the trauma that that brings. So... yeah, I found community in a group of people that, you know, before I found out the truth about myself, wasn't really aware existed, to be honest. And it's great. I've made some really good friends. And I am conscious of what they will say or think with this book. But what I've also tried to do is write this book for people who are not donor-conceived. Because the other donor-conceived people I know, I mean, I would love them to read this book too, but they know the underlying themes, and they know what it feels like, and it's other people who don't.
Yeah. And what about you, Kai?
Yeah. I love my community very much, and it's been a beautiful experience for me to find that community and the queer community as a whole. But, you know, the burden of representation is real. You are one of a few that have this platform to speak, and, you know, I've been in the audience going, oh, I wish they'd say that, or whatever. And I'm sure there are people in this audience now who thinking the same thing, you know, and I can't represent everybody. I can do my best. I think it's an opportunity to speak for a community that's often spoken about, but not necessarily listened to.
And studied by others.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, it is an opportunity, but also I have to hold my own individuality. And as a person releasing a book, you know, entering these like literary spaces, so I have to kind of balance the two and just do my best. Mm. You know, I guess you can get a stinging review from someone within community, and that's always going to hurt more. and, you know, in terms of audience, you know, I welcome readers with PhDs in gender studies, but I don't want them to be lonely, you know? So I try to write this book in an accessible way. and hope that it's read that way. And also in the same way, you know, trans people have not harmed me. Yeah. The cis people have. And so, and then, but also on that note, like, you know, reading a book is such a personal, intimate experience, and I want to honour that intimacy. So that's what I've tried to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, I always remember Benjamin Law saying that he's often described as an activist or an advocate instead of a writer because right. he writes about being gay or because he writes about being Asian. And yeah. I was struck when we were discussing this session, Kai said, please don't ask me about J.K. Rowling. And I'm not going to, but it is, you're often put in this position to be an activist rather than an author.
Yeah.
And rather than a poet or a scientist or, yeah.
Yeah, and like trans people who speak are generally branded as activists.
Yeah.
And it is a political position and that can't be ignored. But yeah, J.K. Rowling, like, that's another
thing. You don't
thing.
Have to talk about it. You don't have to talk about it.
But in terms of representation, the media love asking me about it for whatever reason. And like, but Harry Potter didn't really mean much to me. Like,
it's okay, you don't have to talk about
okay,
it.
We'll move
I was
on.
Just using it as an example of the way we're expected to kind of have, if you're marginalised, you're expected to have this kind of whole holistic approach to the whole community yeah. instead of being able to just speak for yourself.
Yeah.
We can talk about your books. I'm sorry I brought her up. I want to talk about, and you were right to correct me for saying donor-conceived children as opposed to people. For what it's worth to the audience, I'm also donor-conceived, albeit with a known donor, whereas Sarah with an anonymous donor. So that is why Sarah said, Maeve, I know you know that they're adults. I am a grown-up. and I want to talk about, but I want to talk about children, and I want to talk about the stories we tell them. I was struck by, while reading both books, about the way children make meaning out of stories and that knowing the stories of our families and our histories help us understand our place in the world. Kaya, the sections where you wrote about discovering the histories of queerness in your family were really moving. And Sarah, when you come to learn about how you were conceived and your ancestors and connect to your sister, they were some of the most personal and least journalistic sections in a way where you really came to life and you could sense your pleasure in finding out this information. Do you think becoming writers and making a profession out of storytelling was a way of leaning into this need to carve out meaning?
No.
Yeah.
Because, like, maybe the sections where I found family were the kind of most lively for you or other readers, but the point of this book is not just to tell my story, it is to tell the story of the entire gigantic mess that is donor conception. We don't know how many donor-conceived people there are in Australia because no one has ever bothered to keep the records. And in fact, where records have existed for donor-conceived children, showing who they have been born from, those records have been destroyed deliberately, including my own. And there is no national register of donors, male or female, sperm or egg or embryos in Australia, and we do not also keep track of gametes which come in from overseas. And there have been fertility doctors who have used their own sperm on their unwitting patients in Australia, as I reveal in this book, and overseas. And donors are encouraged to sell their DNA for anything from hundreds to thousands of dollars. If you're an egg donor in the US, you can sell your eggs for $100,000 US. And it is out of control. So there may be a bit of eat your vegetables in this book, but it is really important to lay out what is known and what is not known and what the problems are. So, yeah.
While we're on that, yeah, let's stay on that topic for a minute. I'm interested in what you think the values are that underpin this industry. And if you read Sarah's book, the stats and facts about it, it's a damning record. Of how poorly it's been regulated as an industry. But why do you think as a society the industry has grown the way it has, and what do you think it says about the way we view family or parenthood that it has been so inconsistently regulated or not regulated at all?
So it's not regulated at a national level in Australia, and half the states and territories also have no legislation for fertility treatment and the fertility industry whatsoever, not just donor conception, but the whole thing. And I think part of that is due to fertility industry lobbying. Part of that is politicians not wanting to go against would-be parents or babies because babies are really cute. And this is an industry, make no bones about it, this is an industry which cloaks itself in babies. It is very hard to argue against soft focus, kind of pastel hued shots of babies, right? So it has been a real kind of blah, la la, stick your fingers in your ears and hope the problems go away. And of course they don't. We know they don't. We know in adoption that biological families matter, and donor conception is no different. So it is time for a reckoning, I think.
Hmm. Kaya, as a queer person, and more specifically a trans queer person, do you see the way the IVF industry operates as echoing other forms of marginalisation within the health system? Obviously, the IVF industry is quite corporate in Australia and overseas, and you've had to engage with the medical system in order to transition. Do you see kind of values underpinning the whole medical system rather than just this pocket of it around family and around sort of...
Yeah, it is quite, I don't use the word paternalistic, but it is quite patronising and arrogant. I think as queer people, we're very accustomed to interacting with flawed, powerful systems. And, you know, there are trans children now interacting with the fertility industry who are getting their sex cells put on ice in anticipation of future developments they can be turned into gametes, right? This is, like, from very young ages, people are engaging with this. And we are used to these flawed systems. We're also used to reimagining them, right? And I think what I wanted to bring to the fertility industry conversation is that we are marginalized in every single way, in every aspect of life. This is an industry that is often our only access to founding a family, right? And I think what I would, my perspective is, it's a deeply flawed industry with many motivations, as you've explained. But I think if we're going to reimagine it and change policy or something, we should be at the table. Mm. You know, I think that's my take.
Mm. Well, because what we see as well is that on top of what Sarah points out about the lack of consideration for anonymously donor-conceived children to information about themselves, we also see a situation where some people's fertility is prioritised over others. And you write about how trans people in some states have to undergo sterilisation surgeries in order to even change their gender.
Yeah, we're over.
So we've got this massive profitable industry for fertility and parenthood, but then at the same time, they're telling some people they can't have it.
Yeah, and you know, in learning that in my own experience, you know, I had this sort of like dawning realisation. You read in government, state government documents, must have surgery on your reproductive organs. Like it's such an echo of the deepest, darkest parts of our history, you know, like, and I use the word eugenics because that's what it is. Mm. And it's deeply damaging just to read. It's damaging to engage with. It's damaging to undergo. You might have that surgery because that's what you wanted to do. But then even once you've done that and you want to change your birth certificate gender marker, you then have to see two GPs to confirm that that's happened and expose yourself. Those have to be then signed by JPs. So, like, I don't know how many people, I haven't done it, but I don't know how many people are in the room. Do you know what I mean? Like, you sort of, it's horribly othering, very damaging, and completely unnecessary. And reform is easy. It's not politically easy, but it's, who does it affect? You know, how many people? It's a very small minority, but it's abhorrent. Mm. Yeah.
On that topic of reform, I would say if we're going to reform the fertility industry, we have to stop and fix it for the children first, because we cannot go on damaging children. There is, you know, the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is the most successful human rights treaty in the world and in the history of the world. And Australia signed that in 1991. And that says that all actions concerning children should have the best interests and the welfare of the child paramount. And that means when you set up any sort of industry which makes children, like literally makes them, you have to put the child first. Oh. And then we can talk about equity of access, for instance. But I do not think we can go on making children who are conceived via donor conception, not just anonymous donor conception, but donor conception full stop, who do not know not only their biological parents, but all their biological half-siblings. Because any other person would not be okay with being told that they had 6 brothers and 15 sisters out there that they were never allowed to know.
I mean, you do point out in your book, though, that generally people with known donors do know.
So that is a particular situation.
Yeah.
And I would say that is by far not the majority of people who use donor conception.
And this is what we were discussing beforehand, that there's an idea that the IVF industry is there to serve kind of more complex or queer family structures, but the bulk of people using it are heterosexual couples anonymous donor conception.
And that's what we don't talk about. I mean, I have found studies as late as 2013 saying up to 90% of heterosexual couples who use donor conception will not tell their children the truth. Mm-hmm. So that's not having an anonymous donor out there that you can't access. That's never knowing that your father or your mother is not your father or your mother. And that is a massive problem.
And you state in your book how the industry very much instructed parents to do that. Isn't that right?
So they used to say, look, we'll match the donor to the biological father or whoever. They may still say this now, I don't know. And that will enhance the lie. Because if we get a brown-haired donor with blue eyes and your dad has brown hair and blue eyes, your social father, I mean, it will be less likely that the child will know or ever guess the truth. And there is, to this day, no government process or state process which will tell donor-conceived people the truth. So if your parents don't give you the truth, it's highly unlikely anyone else will, unless you do a DNA test or you do the maths in biology class in high school, or someone else tells you the truth in a really unpleasant, unexpected way. And all of those real-life examples, by the way.
And I suppose that's kind of what I was referring to earlier with the notion of what values are underpinning this industry, in that when we've got an industry encouraging straight couples to lie to be able to uphold the idea of a nuclear heterosexual family, it's about trying to protect, I suppose, a conservative view of family. And I think
I don't know
that
if it's about that so much as money. I think it's about money.
I mean, conservative families and money are pretty, like, close values.
I mean, industry and money, they are
industry
like
and money.
This. The Venn diagram is a circle. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's about not having full transparency across the community of what a particular sector is doing.
Mm.
Because that would be harmful to their business interests.
Mm. And they're very profitable.
They are.
You speak about the encouragement to lie to children and how common it is for especially straight parents to lie. It's much harder to do it as a queer family.
Yeah, there's some questions.
Questions are asked.
Yeah.
Both books involve information being withheld from a child, supposedly to protect them. And often when we talk about honesty and children, it's this really reductive, oh, well, we tell them about Santa Claus, or when can we tell them about the birds and bees? We don't talk about the bigger family truths and when they're discussed. How have your experiences finding out quite major information about each set of parents impacted the way you yourself view parenting and the way you view how children should be spoken to, Sarah?
I don't think it's changed anything, to be honest. Before I had kids, I knew I was donor conceived and I would never have lied to them about that, and since having children, nothing's changed. I don't have an answer to the Santa question. That's really hard. I do think you just tell children the way it is. I mean, they don't care. Whatever you tell a child, whatever they grow up with, that's normal. And I don't know why you'd like make life more difficult for yourself, to be honest. That seems crazy. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of models in my life where I've seen families talk to their kids about very difficult topics like rape, suicide, you know, mental health, in age-appropriate ways, because they want their child to be a force for good in the world. And it, I don't want to say it works, but like it, having those conversations is possible from a very young age if you just pitch it to them in a appropriate way. And you know, they don't. A lot of people don't. I mean, there's people in that they don't. People assume their kid is like not going to be a rapist. Do you know what I mean? But there's like lots of parents.
I mean, yeah.
But yeah, but there's lots of parents like now, especially in my community, who are like actively working with their children so that they are aware of all these issues and that they don't become a force for bad. You know.
Do you think to your book? Do you think your relationship with your parents would have been different had you known your father had been in same-sex relationships when you were coming out first yeah. as queer and then as trans?
My relationship absolutely would have been different. Yeah. I don't hold any resentment towards my father for that, though. As a parent, he was actually, he was very straightforward in many ways. You know, I remember reading Judy Blume or something, and I'd be like, hey, Dad, what's a brothel? You know, and he would say, it's a venue where people pay for sex and sell sex. And so you could rely on him to be that parent. And that was great. But I think with his queer history and identity, he just completely believed and understood that the world would not welcome him. And there's nothing you can hold against that. I think probably what might have been harder was my other extended family's reaction to it. You know, I feel like we all live in this family system and there's this shelf of silence, and you put the thing on the shelf of silence and everyone walks around it. You live with the secret, even if you don't know it's there. You know, everyone walks around it, it's there, and then someone feels the need to take it down, and then suddenly everyone looks at you and you're the criminal. You know, like you're the one who has brought this bad thing into the family space. And, you know, I felt that experience too in coming out. And when my dad was, you know, when he did tell me about this, he was very weakened. You know, he was dying of cancer. But he felt a driving need to talk about it, and that was his moment to tell this story, and I was honored to be there to listen, and no one else was, which is also sad. You know, he felt he really needed to talk about it, and people didn't want him to. You know, I didn't want to break whatever it was that had been constructed. So it was beautiful to share that with him, and that's really all that mattered in the end.
Yeah, that's... Sorry, I'm just thinking. Don't mind me. Both of your books, and I'm kind of backtracking a bit here, speak to the rights of the child, and you've referred specifically to the Charter of the Rights of the Child, and earlier you spoke to the way that trans children are treated within the system. I'm interested in how we see that conversation more broadly as well. I mean, you write about climate change, you're a tsunami scientist. How can that conversation of children as a group who need to be considered in political decisions be expanded? And in what other ways do you see society or indeed families violating the rights of the child?
Well, the rights of transgender children are attacked on every possible level. If you look at, you know, the convention, every single right a child has is violated in some way. You know, when we're worrying about trans children, we're worrying about providing them with housing, healthcare, access to education, employment, because these are the things, you know, they're kicked out of home, you know, and these are the things that they don't have. Maybe they need a float in Mardi Gras, great, but also they need somewhere to sleep, you know. Yeah. I was thinking about this question coming in, and we've got a friend who's been staying with us who's in the Navy. You know, and she, as part of her uniform, she has to wear these boots which have to withstand 400 degrees centigrade in case she has to fight a fire, right? And I was like, our kids, our transgender kids need their rights. They need access to healthcare, they need mental healthcare, they need to be cared for, but they also need boots that withstand 400 degrees because people are throwing fire at them, left, right and centre. You know, in the last few weeks, you know, you've got this bill going into Parliament. It's always the children that are taken on. And I guess that's a political tactic, but they're also the most vulnerable and need the most support. So, I mean, you can talk about the rights of the child and in disaster science, we talk about exposure and vulnerability. Exposure is where you're likely to experience many tsunamis. Vulnerability is that your house is likely to fall down. And transgender children are both exposed and vulnerable.
And not just in the practical ways of, as you say, housing and things, but in agency, in having agency within the
right
health system.
Right to privacy is also a right of the child. And they're outed, they're exposed, they're discussed, you know, publicly, and they're just not given, they're not given that privacy.
Sarah?
Look, I think in donor conception and fertility treatment, the rights of the child are pretty low down the pecking order. apart from obviously the best interests and the welfare of the child being paramount, Article 8 says that we have a right to, as far as possible, know and be cared for by our family. And this has been upheld in the case of adoption by the International Committee on the Rights of the Child, where some countries have blocked access and knowledge of adoptees from knowing their biological parents. So that's one thing. But also, like Kaya said, there's crazy things happening in this space. We have, there is a bill in federal parliament now which is being promulgated by the federal health minister, which would allow, if passed, children to be made from three parents, which is not the situation we have now where you may have a same-sex couple who have a donor, known or otherwise. It is where you combine the genetic material of, for example, two women to make a single egg. And then you fertilise that egg with a sperm. And this is done to prevent certain severe genetic conditions. But first of all, we do not know what this does to the resulting child. And secondly, we don't have proper protections for the human rights of donor-conceived children in place at all, let alone the human rights of donor-conceived children made through extremely experimental science. And, you know, you also get situations where you see every now and then a headline in the paper about children being made from the gametes of dead people. I mean, what about that is in the best interests of the child? It is not. It is to assuage the grief of the family who are purchasing that service, and grief is something that I handle very carefully because, as we both know, it is very, very real. But you cannot make a child who will literally never know their parent because they are already in the ground. It violates the spirit of the entire convention.
I mean, I suppose what you're speaking to as well is, as you say, the science coming before the listening and before the engaging with donor-conceived people. And I think that there is, with regards to the kind of the rights of the child, this notion that it's children. But we are here as adults now who are donor-conceived, who have very different experiences and very different approaches to that. And having had a known donor, I'm delighted with my childhood. But it does mean that if you don't listen to the grown products of different types of family structures, different ways of conception, and do prioritise... Sorry, now I'm kind of testifying, but when you prioritise the profit of the industry over the human experience of the now adults, this is where things get awry and incredibly messy. You mentioned that you're a parent now. Do you see children's rights being dismissed in other ways? Do you now, as this has become part of your life, has it opened your sort of perspective and expanded the way you see children being treated in the school system or in other ways?
No, I would say it's made me more sensitised. So anyone in the audience who is a parent will know that once you have children, you cannot watch certain programmes at all anymore. because it's excruciating. Like, you just can't watch, you know, shows where kids get, I don't know, bullied at school, or, you know, there's a particular phase. I cannot do child sexual abuse stories anymore. That's just not on the table for me. So I think that is how it has changed me. It has made me extremely sensitive to certain things that I knew were bad before, but now I'm like, oh, ow, ow. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to love medical dramas and being pregnant. I just can't do them right now.
No, don't do it.
I'm just like, no. I can't. It's too risky.
Yeah, Community, Superstore, something like that. Yeah.
Superstore.
Yeah. Superstore. I love Superstore.
That's exactly what I've been watching. It's so comforting. Yeah. Did you have other things, books or TV shows or art that you found comforting whilst engaging with such serious issues? What's your kind of reading or culture practices as relief? I'm just curious.
So light relief, Woodhouse or Terry Pratchett. But in terms of TV, like as total escapism, I really got into The Bureau, which is about French spies, and Gomorrah, which is about the Italian mafia and extremely violent. So make of that what you will.
Nice and far away. What about you? What's your reading practice, Kyle?
Look, I read quite widely. I do have a filtering process.
What's the filtering process?
Oh, I look at reviews. I look at things. I try to sort of triangulate a little bit. My time is precious. I'm very busy and important. No. It's, you know, you asked me this question, and all I can see is the cover of the last book I read, which I just thought was absolutely breathtaking, which was On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. And it was one of those rare books where you're just like, this is delicious, you know? Like, and I don't want to let go of it. Like, I finished it, it's just still sitting there on the bedside table, so I can look at it, and I can see the cover now. You know, I like to consume the arts, you know? It's all a pleasure to me, yeah.
Do you have particular journalists who have mentored you, or people whose work, especially in the case where they might have included themselves within their work, who you've looked up to and been able to use as an example?
The people I count at the ABC and have counted as mentors have not done that because they are from the ABC. But I would say two of the people that I most look up to and missed are both sadly gone, and they were Mark Colvin and Liz Jackson from Four Corners. And their work is so fresh, will continue to be fresh for many, many, many decades to come, I think. And I try to keep them in mind when I write, and I wish they were here to read it.
I'm going to take us to question time now. I'll repeat it back after you have. Are there any countries in the world that are leading the way, I would suppose say, in the rights of donor-conceived people and in trans rights?
Well, at the end of November 2019, I spoke at the United Nations as part of a group of donor-conceived people on the rights of the child and surrogacy-born people, and that was the first time the UN had ever heard from a group of people actually made by this industry. 2019. And after that, we developed a series of principles for the practice of donor conception and surrogacy around the world. And they were, to me, absolute no-brainers, like the preservation of records in perpetuity, welfare and best interests of the child paramount, all children should know and have the opportunity to meet or form a relationship with their biological parents or biological siblings, don't make kids from the dead, those kinds of things. I think we're actually lowballing on some of them, to be honest, because there was one in there that was, there should be a limit on the number of families that a donor can donate gametes to of five, which is, I mean, it's small in the world of donor conception, but it's big in real life. And the thing about those principles is no country on earth complies with those principles.
I can't name specific countries, but I did have this experience when I was sort of looking into various rights around the world, and then this news article came up in Sweden, when as far as compensating people who had changed their sex marker on official documents, which I thought was a good start, you know?
It's my understanding is it's more expensive to change your name if you're trans on your birth certificate than it is if you get married.
Yes, it's deeply rude. Yeah. Yeah, there was also a woman who was changing her name at the same time as me, who was escaping domestic violence. And also was paying the premium.
Paying the premium.
Yeah.
Which again speaks to the kind of values and the conservative family values that we uphold. Another question. I'm just going to repeat it both for the rest of the audience. The question was, for Sarah, how might your experience have been different knowing you were donor conceived? Was it the deceit or the fact of the donor conception?
So the deceit is bad, don't get me wrong, but it goes so much further than the original lie. So, spoilers, in my book, I talk about how I meet my biological father, who's, you know, he's a pretty good egg, and he gave us some answers about what he had done and how many times he had done it. He donated to three different fertility clinics in public hospitals, and he donated between 150 to 200 times at my clinic alone. And from a single donation, depending on the potency, shall we say, of that donation, you can make anywhere between 5 and 20 straws. Each straw is a treatment. Each straw is a potential child. And at least one of the clinics he donated to also told him that they sent his donations interstate. He was paid every time he did it for taxis. He didn't take a taxi. So all of these things are quite big things to deal with, and it is not just discovering you're donor conceived. It is everything that comes after.
because I'm sitting here, I can speak to having had a known donor myself and being outside of the IVF system, so having that process managed within community and among friends, that I have had a beautiful experience, and my donor's also a good egg, but I had the opportunity to know who he was growing up. So I think that the industry and the way that the profit making has played such a role in yours experience is probably part, is, I would assume, is definitely part of that.
And just not having a right to know anything about any of this. Like, I wasn't allowed to have access to the treatment records of my mother's fertility treatment because it wasn't, they didn't consider me a patient.
Mm.
They literally made me. You know, I'm not allowed to know who my brothers and sisters are. Why? Why not? I don't understand.
They also made an investigative journalist.
So. Yeah.
Joke's on that.
Yeah.
Do we have... Yeah, they should have thought that through. Do we have another question? The question was, just because we apparently have gone rogue and aren't using the microphone, was the legislation different in the UK, and that she was under the impression that all children or adults in the UK could find out their information at 18?
Yeah, so in the UK, as a result of the advocacy of a donor-conceived person, Joanna Rose, who also has some Australian ties, so hey, all donor-conceived children and teenagers in the UK born after 2005 can access identifying information about their donor once they turn 18, not their biological siblings, and they have to know that they're donor-conceived in order to access that information. There are also significant delays on the processing of that information. And the UK, as I say in my book, has this weird little boondoggle whereby once you turn 16, you can apply to the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, I think, to find out if the person you're currently dating is your half-sibling. So a 16-year-old can make an application to a government agency to find out if they're committing accidental incest. And I don't understand why this exists. I don't understand who set it up. I think they need help. All of this could be prevented if you just had legislated transparency from the beginning and the truth, the biological truth as well as social truth, enshrined on birth certificates.
But again, it speaks to the rights of the child. If it's information that's only accessible at 18, or if children can only advocate for their own gender once they're 18, it's presuming that children don't have a right to information or agency. And also, so even if it is at 18, it's still saying that the 12-year-old doesn't get that information.
Also, it's largely untested for those born after 2005 because they haven't hit 18 yet. Mm. So, you know, I expect we'll see a lot more stories about how that is or is not functioning in a few years' time.
Yes, that's a great question. The question was, our stories are never just about us. How did the people in your lives react to you writing a memoir? Kaya?
Yeah, I think it's also an ethical question. If you want an honest answer, we've got sabotage and support. No, somewhere in between. No, I thought about it a lot, right? And that's something you really have to do. When you publish a book, you have to back it. You have to stand by it. And, you know, it represents all of your relationships with the people in your life. And if you have a troubled relationship, that will come out. Some people expect memoir to be a reference. It's not, right? You want to be honest. I addressed the relationships which are most depicted and gave them opportunity to contest or ask for something not to be included. And that's what I did.
Mm. Yeah. Sarah?
Look, the thing about writing a book, Kai and I were saying this before, is you write it and that's great, and then you're like, shit, people are going to read it.
Yeah.
And so I think... it's so hard. I address this in my book. It's sort of like, who owns the truth of your family? And the answer that I came up with is that I own the truth as it occurred to me. And that is the best and the only thing I can do, really.
Yeah. I also felt a need, having not been told the stories of my family, to just tell it, you know, to have it out there. And I think you do have a right to tell your story. And I think freedom of speech is a real thing. It's a sullied term, but, you know, it's something that I believe in. So my therapist talks about, you know, you have your zone of self-respect and then you have your responsibilities, and you just need to find that line and hold it. So that's what I tried to do.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do we have another question? Yes.
So my question is, writing a book and finishing a book can be a bit of a full stop, because once it's done, it's out in the world. And so I'm wondering, when people go and buy this book later and pick it up, if there's anything that isn't in there that retrospectively you would like people to carry with them when they're reading.
That's
now.
An excellent question. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'll let you answer that first, because I want to think about it.
I try not to think about that. No, you know,
what did you miss?
Well, there is a full stop at the end of the book, but your life continues, right? So I've learned new things and new content, but in the book I try to, you know, it captures a snapshot of my life, but I try to use that to talk about ideas. And ideas are concepts and things that won't necessarily change. I didn't want it to date so much. So my life has continued. I've learned new things about my family and myself, but the book is a book, and that's I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Obviously, life doesn't stop after you publish a book. I don't see any of this stopping, because I don't see any of it being fixed. So in my book, at the end, I talk about going to the UN and our group and what we each told the delegates. And I mean, we have to keep doing that, because nothing's changing. We have tried so hard to change things with the government, in the media, and it just, you know, nothing changes. So, I mean, in a way that's good, because it means my book won't go out of date. But for every other aspect, it's quite bad. Yeah.
Well, and it provides you a tool, I suppose, for your advocacy as well.
Yeah.
We probably have time for one, maybe two more questions. Do we have any other? Yes. The question was for Sarah, do you hold resentment for your parents for going into that system knowing that the information wouldn't be available to the child? And the qualification was that the woman's children are donor conceived.
Sure. So, spoilers, no, which I discuss in my book. But the thing is, my parents went into the donor conception program knowing that the donor would be anonymous, but not realising that clinic staff would go into the files afterwards and deliberately cut holes in A4 pages of treatment records to obscure what had been done to whom. That only came out after I went on Australian Story and published this in The Good Weekend, and the Royal North Shore Hospital went, ah, and held not one but two inquiries and investigations into what had happened. So, I mean, what parents were told is one thing. Almost always, there is a whole lot more going on behind that. And what was cut out in my mother's treatment files was not the name of the donor, because that never would have been in there. They never would have put that anywhere near any recipient. What was cut out was the donor code, which lets you know how many children a donor has fathered, when, where, and if there's any resulting inheritable genetic conditions or venereal disease which affects either mother or child, and women have been killed by this industry in Australia, there is no link. There is no liability.
So the answer was no to resentment towards your parents.
Yeah,
you just said it quite quickly, and I think when you've got such systemic problems, the individuals who are then participating, I mean, there's a broader question that we don't have time for about individual agency versus these kind of powerful systems, but I think you've explained it very well. Look, that brings us to the end of the session, and thank you all so much, and thank you to both of you, not only for writing such brilliant books, yes, a round of applause, but also sharing with yourselves today.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.